You're listening to the Cannabis Investing Network. Before we begin, a short disclaimer. The full disclaimer follows at the end of this episode. This podcast is a general communication and is being provided for entertainment and information purposes only. It is educational in nature and is not designed to be a recommendation for any specific investment strategy, plan, feature, or other purpose. Please enjoy responsibly. Hello and welcome back to the Cannabis Investing Network podcast. My name is Manish, and oh my goodness, do we have a fun show for everybody today. Joining us for the first time, Jesse Redmond of Water Tower Research. Welcome to the program, sir.
Manish, it is great to be here. Longtime listener, first time guest. Appreciate you having me. Excited for the conversation.
Well, we're excited to have you, buddy. And Jesse, you're a really interesting guy. I think people probably recognize the name. You're very active on Twitter. I think you have a very unique background as someone who is a former hedge fund manager, but also a former cannabis dispensary operator. And we have so many things to talk about today. You write a lot of research pieces and have some unique opinions on some other undercovered names, which I want to talk about. And then, of course, what's on everybody's mind is, you know, the recent things we saw in the last few days, everything from, you know, Dougie Cass coming out and talking about, you know, how Schedule 3 is happening for sure. And it's right around the corner, to, you know, Kamala Harris's comments, to Fat Joe coming out of nowhere and being part of this cannabis conversation. So I think there's so many elements to talk about, but I think what we're going to be doing today is combining the earnings season, so the focus on the fundamentals, along with, you know, the catalyst conversation and some of the accelerants that we could be hopefully seeing soon in the marketplace.
Sounds great to me. I'm ready.
So I guess, look, just to start, I think it's important to give context. So maybe just explain to people, what is Water Tower Research? How did you end up there, and what are you guys doing there?
Yeah, so I have what I would call either a unique or a strange background, Manish. I think I'm one of the few people that's managed $1 billion in hedge fund strategies and sold $1 million of cannabis. Certainly Jason Wild is probably at the peak of that pyramid, but it takes a little bit of a unique path to get there. I spent 20 years on the buy side, about 10 years of that in the hedge fund industry. And then I transitioned in 2016 and founded and operated a dispensary in California for about 3 years. In 2020, I switched full-time to putting those two skill sets together, the 20 years of investing, the 3 years as a cannabis operator, and started really focusing on that intersection of investing and cannabis. And then I joined Water Tower Research about a year ago. At Water Tower Research, we cover 12 different sectors. We have 16 different analysts. Most of the people that are analysts with us are former sell-siders, a lot of Goldman, a lot of Lehman, a lot of Morgan Stanley folks. And I, like I said, I joined about a year ago. And when I joined, that's when we started covering cannabis. So that's a relatively new thing for us.
Yeah. And I'm on your email list. So I've been seeing the reports, research reports, earnings coverage. So and I'll include a link here, but I really encourage everyone to join Jesse's list, because there's a lot of unique names being covered there that I think, since we've had the brutal pullback in cannabis equities over the last few years, we've lost a lot of research coverage. And you know, you guys doing that research coverage, I think, is very useful, even if it's just to have a unique perspective, an interesting perspective on what's going on, what we should be paying attention to. And, you know, for me, I don't spend as much time covering names as I used to a couple years ago. So being able to see other people's research to me is very helpful, because what I will do then is decide, you know, you can look at it quickly and scroll it and decide if it's something you want to dig into and pay more attention to. Right. So I guess just quickly, you know, you mentioned being a hedge fund manager. Did you ever deal in the small cap space and anything that's somewhat a parallel to cannabis?
Not even close. My background there was focusing on quantitative strategies, so mainly quantitative equity market neutral, things like multi-factor models, things like statistical arbitrage, a lot of short-term trading strategies. Then also did a fair amount in managed futures, things like trend following, global macro, things along those lines. So mainly short-term quantitative, very liquid financial instruments. So it gave me a good context and background for investing in general. And there certainly are certain things that do port over there, but I'm not someone who was like a consumers or a healthcare, you know, analyst or fund manager for a number of years that had direct relevance, because I was focusing on quant stuff. It really doesn't directly transfer over all that well.
Yeah, gotcha. Understood. And so I'm curious, like, just to start here, because it's on everyone's mind. And by the way, recording this on Sunday, March the 17th. So happy St. Patty's Day to everybody. I'm curious, just when you see kind of the dramatic shifts that we're having right now in sentiment, right? Where I think for the first 2 months of the year, we were aggressively bulled up that something is happening soon, sooner, imminent, this week, right? And then that didn't happen as quickly as everyone wanted. And so you started having a pretty extreme pullback. I personally have been kind of waiting on the sidelines, picking my spots. Only in the last couple of days was I buying some MSOX in the threes, but I wasn't going crazy. I was just kind of dabbling. And then Friday, we have, you know, a hedge fund guy, fast money guy, Dougie Cass, who, you know, we don't know a ton about in terms of cannabis, right? He's dabbled in the industry. He's tweeted about it. He's at times been long and then flipped to being short. So, I don't think there's any special love for cannabis, but him coming out and saying very definitively that, look, we have a great source on this. It's happening. The international treaty issues have been resolved favorably. And, you know, it's coming, you know, basically right away in April. So next month, essentially. I guess, what lens do you view this through, right? I mean, it's clearly not, it's partially a fundamental lens, but it is catalyst driven. And right now it's totally rumor driven, right? So I'm just curious to hear your big picture take on that.
Sure. Do you have kids, Manish?
No kids.
Okay. You were a kid once, right?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. So you're aware they have those dolls where you can pull the string on its back and it'll say something?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So if there were a Jesse doll out there and he pulled the string on its back, it would say U.S. cannabis is a state-led growth story with a series of hard-to-time political catalysts.
Okay.
And I repeat that a lot, and that's why I'm here, and that's what I'm excited to watch fold out over the next 3 to 5 years, 5 to 10 years. I think there's different ways to look at that time horizon.
Let's just say that again so we don't miss it. So you're saying U.S. cannabis is a state-led growth story with hard-to-time political catalysts, is that right?
With a series of hard-to-time political catalysts. And so those political catalysts are things you're intimately familiar with. So things like safer banking, if that is still a thing, rescheduling, decriminalization or legalization, and then somewhere along the way, we pick up uplisting. And along with that, you also have a state-led growth story where we have 24 adult-use states, so that gives us 26 more left to convert. And some of these existing adult-use states still have a lot of room to grow. So take California, where I live, where we have 1,200 dispensaries, we have 12,000 liquor stores, and we need 4,000 to 5,000 dispensaries. So although cannabis has been legal here since 2018, this market still needs to grow about 4x to be fully built out. And then I think most of your listeners are aware that New York has been evolving really slowly as well. So I see two things going on, is that the state-led growth story, which is about half the U.S. to convert, and a lot of these existing states building out substantially, that expands the TAM and really expands the revenue base. And then we have a different problem on the other side, which is what the catalysts are helping with. What the catalysts are helping unlock the valuations and bringing in new investors. So I think it's these two pieces of the puzzle together, the state-led growth story, along with a series of underlying hard-to-time political catalysts, that makes this a really interesting opportunity. And we've been kind of, you know, I wouldn't say we've been starving on both sides. We've certainly been starving for a political catalyst, and that mm-hmm. you know, zero has happened since we got really wound up. You know, MSOS peaked on February 10th, 2021 at over $55 a share. Here we are about 1,132 days later, and we're down about 85% or so from that peak. Mm-hmm. And one of the big reasons for that is that Biden made a series of campaign promises and absolutely zero happened. And maybe getting back to where you started, Manish, is that maybe we're finally starting to see some things change on that side.
Mm-hmm. Now, where does Fat Joe fit into all this?
Fat Joe, yeah, he's definitely a key player, key part of the thesis that I had built in. Yeah, I mean, Friday was interesting, right? I mean, I think we were down 4 out of the last 5 weeks in MSOS, something along those lines. And we're having another pretty lackluster week, despite good earnings. That's what's frustrating to me, Manish, is you see the earnings coming in generally pretty good, a lot of beats, some positive things happening there. But that just doesn't move the stocks. You know, what moves the stocks is the potential for 280E to get removed and the potential to bring in new investors. And you can tell me if you see it differently, Manish, but it seems like with the earnings reports, what happens is it reshuffles the existing capital. So just to make things, just to, you know, make something up, let's say GTI has a strong report, and let's say the cannabis has a weaker report, just for, you know, just hypothetical examples.
Sure.
That may pull money out of one and into the other, but I don't see that earnings alone drives a lot of money into these names. Like, it just kind of reshuffles the existing capital. It's the potential for federal reform that really brings new money into the space. And so over the last few weeks, we had seen pretty good earnings, but it was really quieter on the federal reform front. And yeah, that really shifted on Friday, where MSOS was up, was it 14.6%? And that was the, look at my notes here, that was the biggest one-day return since September 5th, and the 14.5 million shares traded were the most shares since September 15th. So about 6 months on both of those, the biggest one-day return and the most shares traded in about 6 months. And, you know, going back to Fat Joe, yeah, was inspired, I'd say, by two things. One was, you know, maybe three things. Kamala Harris hinting that we may be hearing from the DEA sooner than later, her mentioning marijuana legalization, and that on top of that, that Doug Kass quote, and that Doug Kass post on X, it received over 239,000 views. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I try not to read too much into rumors by any one person, but if you're just looking at what moves the space, the fact that 250,000 people saw that is, you know, definitely does make it meaningful.
Yeah, it's no joke, but I mean, we should be careful that, to your point, a lot of volume did change hands on Friday. It did seem a lot of that jump came in the last couple minutes, right? In terms of actual return. And here we are on Sunday, you know, we'll see how it plays out, right? If the momentum continues or not. But I think what you touched on in the middle is a really good point, is that regardless of what happens with rescheduling, you know, the next week or next month, obviously, we all want it right away, right, you know, soon. But it does seem that Kamala Harris is laying out kind of what's going to be one of her main focuses for this election, right, is that she is going to be talking about cannabis. She's going to be talking about potential legalization. Now, is anything going to happen from that? You know, as we've seen, you know, politicians talk a lot, but the action is very limited from that. But I think we can all appreciate, from a catalyst perspective, getting eyeballs in the space, getting attention to the space, that is something that has the opportunity to catch fire, right? That is something that, especially as Ohio turns over this summer and goes legal, you know, these are things that can become more interesting and can become an election time play as this gets mentioned. I always go back to the fact that in 2020, cannabis stocks were kind of languishing over the summer. Until the VP debate, and Kamala Harris said, you know, it's just literally one line that we're going to, I think she said legalize cannabis at the time, so no one has to be in jail. And that really was a huge shot in the arm for the sector. So that has the potential to play out again this year, regardless of whatever else happens.
Yeah, there's the potential that there's a coordinated Democratic effort to advance cannabis reform ahead of the elections to mobilize and sway younger voters. Mm-hmm. And what do politicians want first and foremost? They want to get reelected. And so it's possible at the end of the year, we look back and say, in hindsight, it was obvious is a strong term, but not incredibly hard to predict that Biden would make all these campaign promises, sit on them for the middle 2 years because they weren't as useful for him, mm-hmm. and then really lean into those, you know, in 2024. Also possible that that doesn't happen. You know, I do feel a little bit like people are speaking with a lot of certainty out there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you've been around Manish long enough to remember all the safe banking run-ups and all the other hopes that haven't worked out. And so we can talk about this a little bit more later in the conversation. But I think it is wise for people to still remember this is first and foremost a risk management business. And when I say this, I mean investing is first and foremost a risk management business. And predicting politicians is difficult. It's not fundamental analysis. And I don't see anyone out there that has a documented track record of predicting what's going to happen in cannabis reform, except for the ones that have just said nothing's going to happen forever. And that may, I don't know if that's really insightful or if that's just their curmudgeonly point of view. But broadly speaking, we've seen people be consistently fairly wrong and fairly too optimistic about cannabis reform. So I do feel like it could be different this time. But just saying those words, they say those are the four foremost dangerous words in investing, is it's different this time. And so I would just advise people that are listening that although during, I think there is a reasonable investment thesis to increase exposure during these more politically active periods, or when it seems more likely we could be seeing some of these political catalysts. But going back to the beginning of the conversation, these political catalysts are very hard to time. So I just would encourage people not to get too carried away and, you know, and forget about risk management, because I really do believe first and foremost, long-term success in investing is a product of superior risk management.
Yeah, it's a great point. I love how you laid that up. And one of the things that when we had our call, you know, about doing this episode together, one of the things that, you know, I said to you was, I really want to hear your opinion. I want to hear your kind of name by name analysis, mentioning names that you find interesting and talking about the game plan, right? But about different ways to view it and how do you actually play the space. We have a lot of really great points on that further on in the episode. So I think with that in mind, let's just jump into it, right? Like, talk to me about the earnings season. You know, you mentioned that it seems to have gone pretty well. What are some themes you saw? What are some names that stood out to you? What are your big takeaways from this earnings season?
Yeah, I think it has been a pretty solid earnings season in a couple of different ways. I think it's been a pretty solid earnings season in terms of the performance of the companies. And also, I think it's important that we've seen more beats, which shows us that analyst estimates came down and now the companies are exceeding those estimates. We went through a period over the past couple of years, Manish, I'm sure you remember well, where we were seeing a lot of price compression and not a lot of states were turning on. And analyst estimates were too high, which led to kind of lackluster results. But lackluster results look even worse when the expectations are too high. And so one thing that I did pick up on this quarter is that we're seeing more beats. And so I did an analysis of the tier ones. Mm-hmm. And every tier one, which are the top five U.S. cannabis companies, Curaleaf, GTI, Verano, Trulieve, and Cresco. I think there's a case that you could swap TerrAscend in there, but that's a different conversation. But we have seen more beats. Every tier one beat on revenue, and everyone but Verano beat on adjusted EBITDA. The average revenue beat was 3.4%, and Trulieve led at over 7%. Mm-hmm. The average adjusted EBITDA beat was 12.4%, so a lot bigger beat on EBITDA than on revenue. And Cresco led the way there. 24.55% or 24.5% was how much they beat on adjusted EBITDA. And so maybe that, you know, you remember Cresco talking about that year of the core, and we can talk about SG&A containment as well. But we did see a lot better expense controls at Cresco, and I think that's one of the reasons that they did have that big adjusted EBITDA beat by 24%. You know, Curaleaf on adjusted EBITDA was not far behind at a little over 22%. So I think the first thing that I noticed is that we are seeing more beats in every single tier one beat on revenue and everyone but Verano beat on adjusted EBITDA. So I think that's a positive way to start things.
Yeah, for sure. And let's actually talk about that, right? So what's generating those beats in your opinion? So we've have, you know, some smallish revenue beats, although any beat is good, right? But the EBITDA outperforming that considerably. So is that a story of certain states being really strong, like Maryland, right? Mm-hmm. Although Cresco doesn't have Maryland, right? Or is that a story of certain markets having, you know, price compressions leveling off or going the other way? Is it a story of cost containment? What's your read through on, you know, the trends of these beats?
Yeah, I would say the three things you mentioned. We had Maryland, which turned on July 1st, and a lot of the tier ones are maxed out there with four stores. So certainly that's helpful. When markets flip to adult use, they tend to be pretty healthy margins as well. So that's obviously impactful. The other one you mentioned, price compression, that's getting harder to generalize about Manish, isn't it? Because every state is different. Some states are getting better, some states are worse. So to speak broadly about price compression, I think has gotten a little bit more challenging. If you look at the data from Cannabis Benchmarks, year over year, according to their data, we're about flat on flower prices. There's some seasonality to that, but we've been pretty flat over the last year. And so I think you've seen some markets, Massachusetts was pretty hard for the first half of last year, but that's leveled off a bit. Illinois has been getting more competitive. California continues to be really hard. And then you have the newer markets, so like your New Jerseys and your Marylands, which continue to be stronger and healthier margins. So I think that I wouldn't say prices have rebounded strongly, but flat sure feels like a win after seeing so much compression over the past couple of years.
Sure.
So I think Maryland is a good point. I think leveling out flower prices is a good point. And then I would say that we've seen better expense controls. So I took a look at some data yesterday, and on average, across these top five tier ones, SG&A, so your selling, general, and administrative expenses, declined 1.8% year over year. And going back to Cresco, Manish, Cresco led the way at minus 16.1% in terms of their reduction of SG&A expenses. Trulieve not far behind at minus 13.6%. So I think that it's going back to Cresco, they beat on adjusted EBITDA by 24.5%. And one of the reasons for that was because their SG&A declined 16% year over year, which goes back to that concept they laid out, which was year of the core, trying to get more efficient. I think they did a pretty good job of that. And they did a good job as well benching analysts and investor expectations, which led to that big beat. The only one of the top five that bucked the trend was GTI, and their SG&A jumped 30.9%. And I didn't have time to look into it too much yesterday, so I asked one of your regular guests, CanInvestments on Twitter, Nick, and he responded to my tweet talking about some how this is driven more by some unique M&A accounting, so it may not actually be as big of a jump in reality as it sounds like on paper at 30%. But if you exclude GTI from that, the other four on average reduce SG&A expenses by 10% year over year from 2022 to 2023. So I think that's one of the reasons we saw especially the stronger beats on the adjusted EBITDA side. And I also think that points to one thing that might be helpful for the industry in the long term was that things got so hard in 2022 and so hard in 2023, especially the first half, that the MSOs and really all the cannabis operators are really forced to find religion around expense control. And I think if we do see some new states turn on, and if we do get some progress on federal reform, we might look back and take that as really one of the blessings from 2022 and 2023, is that businesses did get quite a bit more efficient.
Yeah, so it's an interesting point you're making, right? And I haven't dug into the GTI filings yet, and we'll do that when Nick and I do our quarterly review, which is coming up soon. But it's interesting with GTI because they're running countercyclical to the rest of the industry. Right. Last year, they had enormous CapEx spend while everyone was pulling back considerably. I mean, cutting CapEx to the bone, really, while GTI was spending like crazy. They had a couple of large cultivation operations, which they either expanded or completed expansion on. So them ramping SG&A to coincide with, building out a facility once it's built out, that sort of makes sense. And then maybe part of that is also, M&A accounting, as Nick was saying. Right. Yep. So. That is interesting to see, but it's also interesting. You have the cyclicality whereby the industry overbuilds when the capital is easy, and then it's forced to pull back considerably. And so much so that I was talking to a kind of a mid-tier MSO who said, we're looking at more deals than we've ever looked at. And their point was basically the quality of opportunities available to us and the prices that we're able to acquire them at have never been better than what we're seeing right now. Now, the crux of that, though, is that I think they're looking in places which there's not a lot of appetite for, right? So looking in states which are not considered attractive, right? If you're trying to do a deal in Maryland or Ohio today, you're probably still paying a heavy premium to be in one of those states, right? Whereas they're looking at it and saying, where are some less obvious places, maybe that we already are, that we can add some scale to? And we can unlock some very creative opportunities because nobody else is looking at those. So I'm curious, you know, you touched on very nicely what's going on with some of the large players. Is that trend being echoed in the mid-size and smaller players, or is there a different story happening there?
Yeah, so my initial analysis, and I haven't filled out the top the tier twos in my spreadsheet, but just kind of eyeballing the results, it seems like you are not seeing a stronger result from some of the tier two operators. And I think that has a little bit to do with scale, and then also in terms of some of the markets that they operate in. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit hard to generalize depending on which one it is. So I think you're seeing general improvements, but I think you've seen more improvements across the tier ones during this cycle. And in particular, I've noticed that on the margin side. And so you know, we're talking about the things that we're driving some of these beats, and I dug into the margin data a little bit. And I was surprised to see that the average gross margins for the tier ones is about 50.4%, and average adjusted EBITDA margins are pushing 30%, so 29.6%. Mm-hmm. And those numbers are healthier. And again, I don't have the data on all the tier twos, but just eyeballing the reports that I've seen, you're seeing more like 40s, even 30s on some of these gross margins than EBITDA margins. You know, we've seen more teens and low 20s on those. So I think you're seeing healthier margins out of the bigger players, which might have to do a bit with scale. And we've seen gross margins improve year over year. So going back to your point about what's driving these beats, and going back to your point about price compression and flour prices, this 3.5% year over year gross margin improvement probably does show that we're seeing more stabilization. And then we're seeing a little bit more improvements on the EBITDA margins as well, where those are up 3.9% year over year. And so I think that might touch back on the expense controls relative to those EBITDA margins improving. If we look across those top five in terms of EBITDA, in terms of margins, gross margins, Trulieve is the leader. That probably doesn't surprise you, Manish, just due to the, you know, vertical nature in Florida. And the adjusted EBITDA leader is GTI at 30%. So 33%. I'm sorry. And so if even though GTI had the higher SG&A, they're still the leader in adjusted EBITDA margins at 33%. And then also not surprising is that Cresco made the biggest improvement, where gross margins there improved 6.5% and adjusted EBITDA margin jumped 14.3%. And so I think the tier twos also improve, but generally less than the tier ones. And I think that goes, again, a little bit to the markets that you're in, but also seeing some of the benefits of scale.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to compare the Q4 to the Q1, because the Q1 will be coming up relatively soon, like probably mid-April, give or take. So it'll be interesting to see, because Q4 and Q1 seasonally are typically the weakest months, unless you're in a place like Arizona or Florida where it's reversed. But Q4 can be quite good, right? It's Christmas time, there's a lot of retail spending, you know, there's holidays, etc. Q1 is typically the weakest quarter in our industry, although that can vary also, you know, and then Q2 and Q3 are typically the strongest. So it'll be interesting to see quarter over quarter, you know, if these trends continue, or if they are short lived, and how they compare, you know, for some of the mid tier names. So, you know, one of the names that we have on our notes here is talking about, you know, the old Columbia Care or Cannabis. And I mean, I know that's one people have been looking at a lot. I think part of the weakness in their price has been the fact that, you know, they have two Virginia licenses. Mm-hmm. And the Virginia deal that was cut looks like it's going to be vetoed by the governor, although we don't really know.
Yep.
He did veto the other cannabis bill, which was more related to protecting parents who use cannabis. You know, there was supposed to be some grand bargain around bringing a stadium to Virginia, and then, you know, in return, he would help pass Democratic priorities like a legal cannabis market. And I mean, the fact that they might get neither of those things is kind of, you know, a pretty sad thing to think about, right? Because those are both things you would think are obviously good for the state of Virginia. But So I think part of it, you know, people have talked about, you know, some of the weaknesses with cannabis. And I think the earnings, although I haven't gone through them in detail, did seem to indicate that. But I actually think it's a probably, if you think that Virginia is not going to pass, I'll put it another way. If you think that Virginia is going to pass, that in itself would be enormous for a company that has two out of the four existing licenses, right? Whereas if it doesn't, you know, that's obviously not good for cannabis.
Yeah, it's been interesting to watch how the cannabis and Cresco have performed since that merger was called off last year. You know, the Cresco share price has improved substantially, while cannabis has been negative since then. The cannabis does tend to do, has historically done really well during these periods of optimism when we have rallies. You know, last year I was tracking a portfolio called the Reform Runners, where I had kind of goes cannabis, air, Juicy, and maybe Forefront were that portfolio. And that was something I did when I had a subscription to Y Charts, and that ended at the end of last year. So I haven't been tracking it this year, but they were one of the ones that tended to outperform, you know, during these periods, like we saw on Friday, where they acted like a, you know, basically like a higher beta play. That's been changing a little bit. And the other thing going on with that stock, Manish, is the changes in leadership, right? Where Nick did step down. David is now the CEO. So I think there's been some changes there. They do have a fair amount of debt on the balance sheet and have been doing some dilution as well. But that's contrasted with valuation, right? And so the valuation is, you know, among the cheapest out there. And so I think there probably is some opportunity there for folks who want to dig in and learn more and try and understand if it's worth, you know, if the valuation is worth it, given some of the challenges that are out there. But yeah, they have a lot of great assets. I think it's about with them trying to figure out how to make the most of those assets. And that's where I think Cresco, why that merger, you know, made sense, was because Cresco had the wholesale business. There's an opportunity to get much more vertical there. Cannabis has a great footprint, has a tremendous number of retail stores, but they've struggled a bit to make those stores as productive as possible. So some of those doors are a little bit lower revenue doors on average than the other companies out there. Mm-hmm. And so I think cannabis is one of those stories where there's a lot of room to improve that business. And I think if we get Schedule 3 and it helps their cash flow profile, we might look back and say, yeah, this is a pretty, you know, compelling on a valuation basis. But I would encourage everyone to take a look at that and, you know, make their own decision.
So let's shift gears here and let's talk about, you know, strategy and how to play where we are today, and specifically some of the names you talked about, right? So when you look at cannabis, when you look at Forefront, when you look at Juicy, in a nutshell, you know, let's say those are higher risk, higher reward, or maybe highest risk, highest reward, maybe, right? I'm curious how you think about that, because on the one hand, you go, look, as fortunes turn around and, you know, capital comes back into the space, those names can really pop, right? But at the same time, you go, well, you know, they have balance sheet issues, you know, maybe there's management issues, they haven't really, you know, done the best job of convincing us, you know, that they can execute. How do you weigh those things in your mind? How do you look at that and you know, decide what makes the most sense?
Yeah, so when we're talking about the potential for Schedule 3 and the potential for reform, I break it down into three ways that you can play it. There's probably more than three ways, certainly are more than three ways out there, but one, I'll give kind of three different ways that I've talked about it. One way is, if you're someone who thinks schedule reform is imminent or coming soon, one thing you could do is buy the companies that may benefit the most and have historically bounced the most during these periods. And so you touched on those names like cannabis, names like Forefront, names like Juicy, you know, Air doubled or tripled in pretty quick order last year. This strategy, I would say, is probably the highest risk and has the highest reward, because you're buying businesses that would benefit the most from federal reform. So sometimes they may have negative free cash flow. In some cases, they have debt maturities coming up. And they generally tend to be more levered. But if you think that there's a 90% probability, or you're really confident about federal reform, doing something like that, buying, you know, a basket of those names, or like you talked about, Manish, buying something like MSOX, which is the 2X MSOS, or, you know, some people may do things like look at options for MSOS. There's a few different ways to play play federal reform if you're optimistic, but one of them would be to buy these businesses that are more levered to federal reform. So I would call that a more aggressive approach for someone who's optimistic we're going to see change, and change, let's say, sometime before the election.
And sorry, let's just talk about that for a second. When you say that they're going to benefit the most and be the most levered to it, let's just explain why you think that. Is it that, I think we've talked about this before on the show, but the idea that some of the biggest beneficiaries will be companies that are losing money today, but if you sub out 280E, suddenly they're making money, right? They're yep. going from cash flow negative, where now it's burn, now it's raising capital, et cetera, to, hey, cash flow positive, you know, suddenly we've got some options, we've got some increased optimism. And, you know, Air, for example, one of the reasons they were trading so poorly, although everyone was getting hammered, they were getting it especially bad, was debt concerns.
Yes. Right?
If you have concerns over your debt rolling over, we got a problem. But as there is more capital entering the space and more optimism, then that helps assuage some of those concerns. So sometimes the biggest return is just when companies go from being priced like they're going to die,
yep.
or have some kind of, you know, huge dilution event, to suddenly saying, hey, there's some hope now. You know, it doesn't mean it's the rock star company. It still could be challenged, but it goes from being, you know, close to a zero to being having some upside opportunity to it. Sometimes that's the biggest re-rating that you get.
Yes. And I would also say, if we want to be fancy, that there's two levels to reform. There's federal okay. reform and there's state level reform.
Okay.
And I think it may be helpful to overlay the two of those. So with Jushi, they would benefit from federal reform. They mm-hmm. do have debt maturities coming up. They do have a lot of debt on the balance sheet. They do have negative free cash flow. And so there are a few reasons that Jushi would benefit substantially from federal reform, more investors entering the space, more lenders entering the space, rates coming down, all of those things would be helpful to Jushi. So levered to federal reform. On top of that, think about what new states could potentially come online this year. And you should handicap these, you know, each investor should handicap what they think the probabilities of these are. But take, you have Virginia, you have Pennsylvania, and you have Florida, and these would be 2025 in terms of when they would actually turn on. But these are going to transition to adult use in 2024. And if you take a business like Jushi, you know, they do have meaningful exposure, you know, in Pennsylvania. They do have meaningful exposure in Virginia. If you take Air, you know, you're talking about a stock with a relatively small market cap that has 62 stores or 64 stores in Florida. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's helpful when you're thinking about this to say, okay, what do I think happens at the federal level and who will benefit the most? Second is on these state level catalysts, which we can dig into a little bit more, who might benefit the most from those? And then if you want to make like more of a catalyst type play and say, okay, I'm thinking about the federal catalyst, I'm thinking about the state catalyst. If things go as I expect, so if you're just a super bullish guy, you think 280E is going away with Schedule 3 in the relative near term, and you think, you know, let's say, you know, Virginia, Florida, and Pennsylvania are all going to flip, then you can figure out who has the footprint in those states, who would benefit from federal reform, and then figure out, you know, the companies that may benefit from this combination of state and federal reform together.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, right? I mean, I was talking to somebody the other day about Trulieve, and mm-hmm. You know, one of the things they pointed out to me was like, look, Trulieve's two biggest states are PA and Florida, right? So those are two medical states, and you know, there's potential for Florida being on the ballot. We're going to find out in the next 2 weeks, right, if that's happening. Pennsylvania, you know, our friend Hirsch says it's probably not this year that it's going to pass, you know, but there's a chance for next year, so we'll see. But, you know, PA would be enormous for MSOs, right? It's highly concentrated MSO state. But the challenge, you know, is, and this is what we're faced with so often in this industry, is this binary outcome. So if no reform happens, like let's say 280E, for example, then nothing changes, right? So how do you plan for that scenario, right? Well, you probably go for things that have good existing cash flow, you know, have a better balance sheet, don't have debt rolling over or can deal with it, et cetera, right? But if reform does happen, whether it's federal or whether it's something like PA, you know, for example, if you're heavy in PA today, you're in a tough situation because the market's getting more competitive. They've just allowed independent growers to go vertical, so there's more stores opening up. It's going to be a harder and harder market until finally it flips to recreational, right? So I guess, to your point, you need to assign some probability to these things and then decide, you know, how do you want to play it, right? Do you want to, you know, maybe allocate, sprinkle some money into things that you feel are the highest risk? Or would you rather, and how I typically looked at it is to say, look, where am I getting appropriately paid risk return to participate in what I think could be some good catalysts this year, right? What are some names that, regardless of what happens, I think will be okay? And who's going to have, you know, the most upside in certain situations, and how likely are they to happen?
Yeah, so I think the strategy we've talked about so far is the highest risk, highest reward. I would say the most conservative, and I would even call it conservative because we're still talking about microcap, small cap, you know, cannabis names. Still a very risky strategy, but would be to invest in some of these more cash flow type names that are less dependent on reform. We might even call them reform independent. And names on that list would be, you know, GTI is an obvious example there. C21 Investments is a nice example there. And, you know, Grown Rogue is another example there. Businesses that can be self-funding. Ideally, overlay that self-funding with still getting some growth, right? Because it's not, we're in cannabis for the growth. Mm-hmm. And so you can find companies in cannabis that have crazy strong balance sheets, but oftentimes that's paired with a not real exciting income statement. So try to put those two pieces together. But if you want to get cannabis exposure, but not be as subject to these reform catalysts, then yes, I would say strategy number two would be to look for the more of those more reform independent names. Won't bounce as much, most likely, as some of the other names, but also probably won't get hurt as much if you're wrong.
So let's just talk about that for a second, because I think that's a really interesting perspective. And I think those are three names that you don't typically hear put in the same category, right? So Green Thumb, okay, we all understand that, right? That's cash flowing, returning shareholder to capital to shareholders, has a low absolute debt. So we all understand why that one is reform sort of independent, right? But let's talk about Grown Rogue and C21. So I know a little bit about these companies. I don't know a ton about these companies. You know, eyeballing those two, they kind of sort of fit in the same category where you go, look, they're penny stocks, they're small companies, they appear to be well run, they're generating actual cash flow. With C21, I believe it's just Nevada. Is that right?
Yeah, they just acquired an additional store in Nevada. And so C21 was one of those businesses that did have a real strong balance sheet. But as Nevada has been a fairly challenging market, fairly saturated, not a ton of growth since the pandemic peaks, their income statement had been a little bit less sexy, but they did make an acquisition. I think they announced it Thursday or Friday. I think it's supposed to close in early April. And so hopefully that'll help them get a little bit more scale, a little bit more growth into that equation.
Yeah. And so like, that's an interesting one where you go, you know, because people often eyeball stocks and say, well, the stock trades at, you know, however many pennies. So it has a lot of upside, you know, it's a risky name, but it has a lot of upside. But, you know, that's what it signals to the market. But in reality, when you actually dig into a company's EV and then their debt and their outstanding shares, that may or may not be true. Right. So, and I apologize, because I don't know C21 in detail, but I did look at it in the past. And I said, yeah, look, it's interesting what they're doing. Clearly well run, clearly financially, you know, they're doing something right. But then on the other hand, you go, you know, if you look at owning, you know, two dispensaries in Nevada, even two highly productive ones, the EV doesn't quite add up. So I'm not sure what the plan is, right, for these guys. And now, you know, as you're pointing out, they have an acquisition. I think it was like $3.5 or $4.5 million.
Yep.
But you know, they're raising capital against that, right? Even though it's a pretty microscopic acquisition, right? But it seems like it's accretive, going well for them. But I guess the idea is, to your point, like if we get Schedule 3 tomorrow, like how much does that really benefit them? Sure, you know, financially, maybe it benefits them on the retail level, but are these the companies that capital will flow to, right? And probably not for C21, because it's a pretty centralized or pretty localized play. But Grown Rogue, maybe, right? I mean, they seem to have a lot going on. They're going to New Jersey, they're going into other states. And if they can replicate their model, then you see maybe the story getting bigger and bigger, right? Mm-hmm. But I guess that's my high level just on those two names. I don't know if you want to share why you put them all in the same category.
Yeah, so I just put them all in the same category as being less dependent on reform, but certainly not a lot in common with the businesses and the states that they're in. I think Grown Rogue has probably a little bit more growth potential, like you mentioned. You know, Minnesota. I think that consulting agreement with Goodness also expands to Maryland, if I recall correctly.
Yeah.
Then also they are getting into New Jersey on the cultivation, then also participating in some of the economics on the dispensary side there as well. So Grown Rogue, I would say, is a bit potentially more of a growth growth story. But yeah, I would just put them in the same category as being less dependent on reform. But in terms of this, the businesses being similar in terms of the assets or anything else about them, yeah, I'd say they're pretty unique in that regard. But if real money comes into this industry, Manish, which is why I'm here, you know, I'm excited about the investor base expanding. I'm excited mm-hmm. about new capital coming in. I'm excited about things like public pension plans, things like hedge funds, things like foundations and endowments participating. I don't think that they go to those real small names just because they can't put the kind of capital to work that they need to.
Sure.
And so I think when the institutions come in, that they're largely going to invest in the tier one names. And so I think that's the third strategy to talk about, is diversifying across those, you know, top five. Mm-hmm. Those are the most liquid. Those are the ones that have the most scale. Those are, in many cases, the most experienced, most proven management teams. And if you look across those tier ones, Manish, the top five MSOs are only 9% institutionally owned. If you look across top alcohol and tobacco stocks, the research I did shows those are about 76% institutionally owned. And if you just scan other mature sectors like, you know, tech and healthcare, it's not uncommon to see 60, 70, 80% institutional ownership in those names. So I don't think overnight, with rescheduling, even with legalization, even with uplisting, we're not going to go instantly from 9% to 75%.
Mm-hmm.
But just think about if the institutional ownership doubles and it goes from 9 to 15% or doubles, or I mean, goes up 50% from 9 to 15 or doubles mm-hmm. and it goes up to 20%, that's going to make a massive difference in these names. I mean, really, one hedge fund investing right now and putting, you know, $10, $20, $30 million to work would make a crazy difference in this, in, you know, in these illiquid names. And so I think one way to play it, which is maybe a middle ground between this kind of high flyer, more dependent on reform names versus the more conservative reform independent names, is diversify across the tier ones, and you're going to get broad exposure across the U.S. It's kind of like investing in multi-strategy funds in the hedge fund space. Like when I think about single strategy hedge funds, I think about those almost like single state operators. And then when I think about multi-strategy hedge funds, I think about almost those almost like the MSOs. And by owning the top five MSOs, that may be the equivalent of owning 30 or 40, you know, smaller stocks, just because of the, you know, number of stores, the cultivation, the number of states that they're in. And so I think that you could find the middle ground by buying those tier ones and maybe get ahead of that really large institutional capital flow, which I think is likely to come into these bigger names. The other part about the institutional capital flow is being mindful of exchanges as well. You know, we had TerrAscend uplist to the TSX last year. Mm-hmm. We had, you know, Curaleaf, you know, follow after them. And so I think that's another variable that could be important. Some of the hedge funds and institutional capital will dip in and buy things that, you know, are on the OTC. But I think in some cases, those TSX listings, which haven't made a big, real big difference so far. But I think if and when the institutional capital does show up, that's when those TSX listings could be potentially more important as well. And that points a little bit more to Curaleaf, which is the world's largest, also on the TSX. Those factors help. And then TerrAscend, which is one of the best run firms. They're also on the TSX.
So, and just on that point, do you think that, like, where does MSOS play a role in this, right? If someone big comes in and says, look, I just want exposure to the tier ones. I mean, I can't remember the number, but it's like 80% of MSOS is basically the top five names,
yes.
Right? So, you know, is that good enough? Somebody just buys the, you know, the index and they're happy with it? Or do institutions say, no, we want to direct exposure and we want to either, you know, dive into the OTC or the TSX and own these outright?
So I think certainly money will flow into MSOS. Certainly it being NYSE listed makes a big difference there. It's the most liquid, which makes a big difference there. But generally, so take a hedge fund pod at Millennium, for example. That hedge fund manager that gets assigned cannabis, if he wants to really earn his keep and have some career security there, he's probably not going to be just buying an ETF. He's going to want to dig into some of those names and, you know, and find his favorite of the top 10 or find his favorite of the top three. I saw that there's an endowment in the Midwest that's investing in cannabis. and they're not real sophisticated. You know, they know who a GTI is, but the conversation we're having today, a lot of these names they probably aren't as familiar with. And even in that case, they may own some MSOS, I can't recall, but they were dipping more into three or four of those top five names. So my experience dealing with these more institutional allocators is you could see people use the MSOS as a more liquid trading vehicle, but I think they'll probably ultimately dig into some of these larger names individually.
Interesting. And it's a really good point you pointed out there that I just want to emphasize, the idea that some of what drives the decision making might be optics and perception. And if you're, you know, charging your investors a certain fee, it's hard to justify that if you're just buying an ETF, right? Versus if you say, look, we're doing the due diligence, we're doing the legwork, we're deciding which one of these to buy and which ones not to buy and how much to buy and when to sell them. That's why we're charging you, you know, 2 and 20 or whatever they charge these days, right? Because that's how they justify their existence, is doing the extra level of work rather than just buying an ETF.
And we also remember on the ETF, you have about a 75 basis point management fee. And so they would catch heat for, you know, the fees on fees type arguments.
Sure.
And also you're using swaps, and that's the reason it can be on the NYSE. And I don't know the details of those swap agreements, but I don't know exactly what that number is, but let's make up a number and say it's adding 5% or something like that. You could look into it and get something closer, but there is a financing fee on those swaps. And so for a couple of reasons, using MSOS is a more expensive option as well. The benefits of that are the instant diversification, the more liquidity, and being on the higher exchange. So certainly trade-offs to think about there.
Yeah, sure. It's an interesting point. So let's keep rolling. One thing on the list here that I really want to talk about is adult use flip, so particularly PA and Florida. I'd like to hear your thoughts on, you know, what the, first of all, the potential for these, like, you know, how real is it? You know, Florida, we're going to find out here shortly if we're on the ballot. And then also how to play this, right? What are some of the most interesting ways and the ways to think about investors putting exposure on for these states?
Yeah, so let's start with Florida, because I think that's the biggest. That's the most populous state on our list with 22 million residents. And what's really important about Florida is they have about 137 million tourists. Under the current construct, the 22 million residents can buy cannabis if they have a medical card. The 137 million tourists cannot. And so when we talk about adult use flips, Manish, sometimes we see about 2x in markets. On the high end, we'll see 4x in certain conditions. I think Florida has the potential to be more than a 2x. It has a robust medical program. And typically during these flips, if you have a robust medical program, the transition to adult use is not as meaningful. Mm. But I think that might be more than offset by the fact that anyone over 21 of these 137 million tourists, they can buy cannabis when it's adult use. They cannot buy it when it's medical. And you think about who these 137 million tourists are. Broadly speaking, they're people that are on vacation, which could be the spring breakers. And they are a lot of snowbirds of the I'm originally from Minnesota, and it was super common for people to spend their winters in Florida.
Yep.
So I think it's going to be a really healthy adult use market. It's about a $2 billion market. I have $1.8 billion down in my notes. And so if we think about a little more than a 2x double, I think that can be a $4 to $5 billion market, which would put it, right up there with California, potentially even larger than California, depending on the magnitude of that flip when it does go to adult use. You mentioned we'll find out in April if it gets on the ballot. If it does get on the ballot, I think it's far from a slam dunk. Mm-hmm. You need 60% there versus the 50% we saw in Ohio. In Ohio, what was that? 57%? Is that what it got?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Florida's polling, better than Ohio was polling, but it does show, that it's not easy to get 60% in these markets. I think the polls, you can correct me, Manish, but I think they're in the high 60s, maybe even approaching, 70%.
Yeah, a bit all over the place from what I've seen, but we haven't hit 60% in any market, right? So I think that's on a rec legalization vote. I shouldn't say that, actually. I think we just hit it in New Jersey. Barely, but in Arizona it was like 59.9, right? So it's definitely going to be something that is not a given, I'll put it that way.
Yeah. And when we talk about the impact to the cannabis industry, some states have more MSO exposure than others. For example, Missouri is a great market, but not a big deal for the MSOs. Maryland is a great market, but is a big deal for the MSOs. Similar size market, one is a lot more MSO exposure than the other.
Yep.
And in this case, Florida has more than 475 MSO-owned stores. Trulieve is the leader there with, my notes show 132 doors, but I could be off by one or two, but over 130 stores for Florida. And so stores are something that's publicly disclosed. And mm-hmm. I think it's important to realize not all stores are created equally. And in some states, you have to think about the wholesale business. You have to think about brands. So I'm going to talk a lot about stores and footprints, but just realize that that's not the end-all, be-all metric. But it just does give us some perspective on who has scale on the retail front. And Trulieve is clearly the leader there with 132 doors. But what I did, Manish, was I took those doors and I divided them into enterprise value.
Okay.
And when you do that, Cansortium with 34 stores and $108 million enterprise value may have the most torque. Also on that list with the Vidacan, I always forget how to say it. Is it Vidacan? Mm-hmm.
Vidacan,
okay. Like vitamin. Planet 13 with the Vidacan acquisition has 26 stores and they have $114 million enterprise value. So I think one way to look at these markets is to say, okay, do I want to just invest in the leader in that market? And so that would get you to Trulieve in this case. Or do I want to look at other factors, which is how many stores do they have relative to their enterprise value, which is not the end-all be-all metric, but gives you some indication relative to their size, how much of a retail footprint they have there. And that does, you know, point to a couple of smaller names with the Planet 13 and the Cansortium as well. Air also, in terms of the bigger companies, that's mm-hmm. a huge deal to them. What is that, about a $300 million enterprise value off the top of my head? And off the top of my head, I think they have 64 stores. And so that's a huge one for Air as well.
Yeah, so just a couple comments. One thing that has not got a lot of traction in terms of has really gone under the radar is that sort of at the last minute, the Florida legislature passed a ban on Delta 8 hemp products. And this is something I've been talking about a lot for years now. And I think it's gone really underappreciated, the effect that it's had on the industry. On the one hand, you know, as someone, I actually just got back from Florida and one of the first stops I made was to, you know, the Delta 8 store. It's kind of funny because Delta 8 is sort of like, you know, when you talk to the operators, the hemp operators there, Delta 8 is like old news. They don't even sell Delta 8 anymore, practically. They moved on to THCA, which, you know, they continue to just keep innovating and innovating ways to get around, you know, whatever the rules are. So I don't know how big the Delta 8 impact will be on them. I read through the actual law. It was a little ambiguous into what is actually being banned and what's not being banned, or maybe I just wasn't able to understand it. But then on the other hand, a lot of these products from the heavy users are not being purchased in store. They're being purchased online. So I don't think you're going to shut down that business. I think people are going to continue to get their product from online, from out of state, et cetera. But what this could mean is that the in-store, so the dedicated hemp dispensaries, quote unquote, are basically forced out of business. Mm-hmm. And although, you know, personally, I wouldn't like that as a visitor, that actually could be super helpful for the industry, especially in a rec market, because when you walk down, you know, areas of South Florida, these hemp dispensaries are really, really active. And what's encouraging, if you look at it, is the price that they charge for the product is quite high, like $15 a gram, you know, 50 to 60 plus an eighth.
Really?
You know, yeah, $40 for a bag of edibles. Like, it's not cheap pricing. Like, it is very, very strong pricing you're seeing from these hemp dispensaries. And they're mostly getting, you know, tourists, seasonal residents, you know, people who, for whatever reason, can't get their medical card or don't want to get their medical card. And you can pay, you know, at these places with credit card. Right. Hmm. I mean, it's legal. Right. So it's going to be really interesting to see the impact that that has, you know, if and when it gets implemented. I'm sure it'll get challenged. The other thing I would just point out, and I'm a big Cansortium investor, so I do believe what you're saying about it having a lot of torque towards the upside. One thing I would just caution is that when you only look at store count to EV, one of the things that you miss is you miss, well, what about all the other states? Right. That's obvious. But one of the things that maybe is less obvious is, okay, you can have 35 stores in the state and, you know, Trulieve has four times what you have, but in a rec market situation where rec turns on, you know, by say mid 25 and the business could double to triple, I actually think one of the benefits you'll see is you'll see price rebounding as supply gets tight. And you're going to see some really, really interesting effects in Florida. I think that one of the big questions is, look, who's ready? Who has the capacity to double or triple their output, right? And if you're still vertical, that's going to be a big problem, right? If the rules don't change in terms of verticality and being able to sell to each other, my hypothesis would be Trulieve is actually going to get an outsized benefit even more than you might imagine because of how much capacity they have, because of their ability to ramp up production so quickly. Whereas smaller players, and Cansortium just PR'd something about like two new cultivation facilities the other week. But that's one of the problems smaller players are going to have. I think the demand is going to outpace the ability to increase supply, especially when we're in this CapEx starvation cycle like we've been talking about, where money is so hard to come by. You need to be ready to go for that, and Trulieve has that and will be ready to go on day one. And so I think they would actually be an outsized beneficiary from going rec.
Oh yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, it's a great point on the cultivation side and the fact that Florida does have the mandatory vertical.
Talk about Pennsylvania.
Yeah, so Pennsylvania is another important adult use market that will hopefully transition in 2025. Pennsylvania is a big state. It's the fifth most populous state with more than 13 million residents. Old medical program, been around since 2018, and a pretty healthy medical program, supposed to be about $1.5 to $2 billion this year.
Hmm.
Different than a vote, the path there to adult use is through a legislative process rather than a vote. Listen to the episode with Hirsch, because he's infinitely more qualified to talk about these things than I am, but he is great. But Governor Shapiro does have a line item in the budget for adult use sales to start no later than January 1st, 2025. We'll see if he can get that done. And they have something called Senate Bill 486, which has been introduced and is working its way through Congress. Trulieve is once again the leader there. It's a really productive MSO state. They have 128 MSO-owned stores. They don't have a cap there. And so in states like Maryland, you see the four-store cap. In Pennsylvania, we don't have that. And so Trulieve is the leader of the 128 MSO-owned stores. They have 20 of those.
Mm-hmm.
But I would also point out that Jushi has a big footprint there. And Jushi may have the most torque with 16 active stores and a roughly $330 million enterprise value. And on top of that, going back to what you were talking about there earlier, Manish, which we also need to look at the cultivation facilities, is Jushi has 131,000 square foot cultivation facility as well. And so I think that relative to Pennsylvania, there's a lot of great MSO exposure there. Curaleaf has a bunch of stores. GTI has a bunch of stores. Verano does as well. Trulieve the leader, but I think Jushi with those 16 active stores and that 131 square foot cultivation facility, when you contrast that with a $330 million enterprise value, is probably an interesting name to look at. By way of disclosure, we do cover Jushi, but speaking, you know, as objectively as possible about this.
Yeah, so I think it's a good point you're bringing up. And like we talked about, right, the re-rating of companies going from, hey, this company is losing money and is maybe left for dead versus not. You know, PA or Virginia could have that impact for Jushi, right?
Absolutely.
So that's super interesting to watch with Jushi and them turning the corner, to your point, could be, you know, a huge re-rating moment for them. I haven't looked at them very closely. I haven't looked at them in years, but I like how you have laid it out and shown, look, this is one of the biggest players, but this is a smaller name if, you know, you want to find a way to bet on that with more torque, as you put it. So I think that's a great place to leave that discussion. We're coming to the end here, but I really want to talk about California because you are a California cannabis apologist. I'm kidding, but you know, everyone, I think like everyone's been burned in cannabis period, but California has really taken no prisoners. And you know, I was talking to somebody who, I don't know if you want to be named, but he said, I don't think Henry Ford could make money running a California cannabis company. So talk to us about what you're seeing in California. You know, you ran a dispensary there, you live there, you work there. You've got a couple of names that you find interesting there. Tell us what we're missing and what people should be paying attention to in California.
Yeah, so I'm more of a casualty than I think I'm an apologist. if things went fantastic, I might still be running a store in California. I was here running a store at the medical days, and I naively thought the move to Prop 64, which is the adult use regime, mm-hmm. I thought that was going to be this great opportunity. Sure. And it turns out with the increase in taxes and regulations and everything else, it made it pretty much impossible for a single store operator to survive. Mm-hmm. So I do spend a lot of time and effort thinking about and covering California, but I try to be realistic about the opportunity here. We're struggling in terms of price compression. We're struggling in terms of overcapacity relative to the number of dispensaries. I mentioned up top, we have about 1,200 stores here. We have 12,000 liquor stores, and we need about 4,000 to 5,000 stores. So it's an underserved market. And it's just been flat out since 2018, been a really hard market.
Yep.
And that's led to a lot of consolidation. It's led to a lot of reduction in canopy, which was necessary, but super painful. But I think I'm not going to pound the table and say we're at the bottom of the cycle. I think that we're getting towards the end of it. And I think we're starting to see some signs of improvement. But it absolutely still is super hard here. But I think there are a couple of characteristics, or maybe even three, you can look at in California for things that are going to be helpful. And that first one is, I think in California, to when you need scale. And there are going to be exceptions to these, like really small craft cultivation where they have a small room and they're killing it with great flower. That business is doing okay. But generally speaking, having more cultivation, having more dispensaries, more scale in this market, because it's pretty low margin. So you do need some size to spread over those costs, to spread out over those costs. And you do need a pretty big revenue base to do well here. And so when you think about scale in California, you have to think about Glasshouse Brands, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they have the 5.5 million square foot facility in Camarillo. They're only using about 1 million square feet of that now. They're turning on another 1 million square feet this year. And they're doing really, really well at that, taking that middle share of the flower market. So it's not outdoor. It's not the absolute lowest end. And most outdoor in California goes to concentrates. Mm-hmm. It is nice greenhouse flower. And that's the bulk of the California market. It gives them great efficiencies using sun rather than having to turn on lights. They do a bunch of great stuff with solar. They do great things with reusing water there, and have a bunch of techniques to really focus on low cost production at scale. So I think Glasshouse, and this is reflected in the share price, Glasshouse has been bucking the trend and doing quite well and capitalizing as others are failing in California. I don't think others are necessarily failing because of Glasshouse, but when canopy comes down in other places and those businesses go out of business, Glasshouse has been able to step in and fill that void. And so I think that's one name definitely people should look at in terms of who could win in California. We cover a company called Leaf Brands, which is quite a bit smaller company and one I don't think a lot of folks would know.
Sure.
But Leaf Brands specializes in making concentrates. They have a 12,500 square foot manufacturing and extraction facility. I'm heading up to Willits, California, which is north of San Francisco, next week to pay a visit there. And so far, they've been doing things like making concentrates, things like live resin, things like the cured resins, your shatters, your butters, your sugars. They're in the rosin business, the solventless business, which is growing quickly in California. And they do a ton in the distillate business, which is commonly used in things like vape cartridges and edibles. So really diversified across the different means of making extracts in California. But up until now, they've been sourcing material from other places. They haven't had their own cultivation. This year, they're just planting their first farm, and that's called Salisbury Canyon Ranch. And when that's fully turned on, that's going to be over 8 million square feet. That's the potential that it has. For perspective, Glasshouse is about 5.5 million. That's not an apples-to-apples comparison, to be very clear, because Glasshouse can get multiple turns per year out of that greenhouse. So that's going to be more productive than just an outdoor facility would be. But it does show you the scale that Leaf has, over 8 million square feet of cultivation. And they're going to be kind of like glasshouses scaling into their cultivation, turning it on as California can handle it. Leaf is going to be doing the same thing. They're starting to plant it this year. Next year, it's going to grow more. It's going to grow more. I don't know if they'll max it out just on California, or if it ultimately takes interstate commerce to max out that farm. But that's going to make a big difference for them, because all of a sudden, they don't need to source material. They can pick up the margin on that business, and they can also improve the quality of their products. So they'll be growing certain sections just for distillate, which will be really THC rich. They'll be growing sections for live rosin, which are things that wash well into bubble hash. They'll be doing sections for live resin, which are characteristics that'll be, you know, that are designed for that extraction process. And so, you know, Leaf Brands is somebody that, rather than focusing on selling flower like Glasshouse does, they're focusing on selling concentrates in the vape market. They have really tasty, awesome edibles. And that business, I think, gets a lot more interesting this year as they plant that Salisbury Canyon ranch and start to get that in-house production.
So I'm just, you know, I know nothing about this company, right? So I'm just, while you're talking, did a quick search and was looking it up a little bit. So 3 cent stock, is that right?
Yep.
Yeah. So obviously a company that's been basically left for dead. But you know, if you like, I kind of like situations like this, and that if you dig into it and you say, hey, there's something here, right? And it actually starts to show results, then that can change very quickly, right? So that's interesting. So that's an interesting idea, right? Of growing. And I think you mentioned it's outdoor.
Yeah, so they'll have some hoop houses, but they'll be doing a lot of full sun outdoor there as well. Because with extracts, you know, outdoor flower doesn't tend to be as pretty, doesn't have the bag appeal.
Sure.
But if you're just growing for extracts, you're not worried about the bag appeal, because it's ultimately jar appeal that you're looking for.
Yeah, sure.
It'll be mainly an outdoor facility.
It's low cost biomass input, right? So we yep. get that. So it'll be interesting to see how that develops, right? I mean, I think that reminds me of the old days of Canada, of trying to, you know, build to huge scale. But you know, like we've been talking about, supply has been coming off the market in California even. And the question is, you know, does this strategy make sense today, right? Can you execute it at scale? How cheap can you get your extracts? And what does that do for the rest of the market, right? If you look at Glasshouse, they're in a position where they're supplying a ton of the market in various ways, and a lot of what they're doing is, you know, other people buying their flower and as an opportunity to basically slap their own label on it, right? Because it's cheap enough. So being a wholesale supplier,
yep,
as opposed to a branded supplier, and at a certain price point, right, that makes a lot of sense for other people just to say, hey, I'm just going to buy it off these guys. It's more efficient, right? So can Leaf do that same type of thing? That'll be interesting to watch. And I like that you're bringing attention to some less followed names, because, you know, that this, there was a time in our industry where there was a lot of these smaller names with interesting stories. And I think you just don't see it as much today. Right. So I'll definitely be interested to hear from you about how this story progresses.
Yeah, and that is a stock that we cover by way of disclosure, so we'll be putting out regular content on them. And if you do want to learn more about it, you can go to watertowerresearch.com, click on the companies tab, and scroll down to Leaf. There's about a 25-page initiation of coverage report that'll dig more into the business.
Okay, quickly, last one name I want to talk about for California before we end is Graham. So the previous parent company, yep, now Gold Flora. Yeah, I mean, this is a name that used to be widely followed and not so much anymore.
Yeah, so definitely a reboot going on there, you know, with the merger and it becoming Gold Flora. What I like about that story, and they're also a client by way of disclosure, we'll have initiation of coverage report out there in the next few weeks. Mm-hmm. But Gold Flora, what I think they're doing is they're nailing the vertical integration side.
Okay.
So if you take a hard market, one of the ways that you can squeeze out more margin and get more revenue is by participating in as many places as possible. And so in the case of Gold Flora, they are focused on high quality indoor flower. They have cultivation facilities in Desert Hot Springs and San Jose, up to about 3,000 square feet of cultivation there on the indoor side. They also have a distribution company called Stately, so they're even participating in the next step there. They have a manufacturing and processing facility that's located along with the grow in Palm Desert. So they're making all their own concentrates, they're making all their own vape cartridges, they're making all their own pre-rolls and edibles, things along those lines. And then on top of that, they have really great dispensaries. So I think they have 16 active dispensaries. And some of those, especially the ones in San Jose that used to be part of Airfield Supply Company, those are some of the most productive productive doors in the state. And so when we talk about ways to win in California, we talked about the benefits of scale. They check that box. Low cost, that's not the model that Gold Floor is going for. They're going for, you know, more of the indoor flower, which lends itself more to the middle to the high end side of it. They are finding some good efficiencies there. So it's not tremendously expensive, but it's not going for the sun-grown model. But what I would emphasize about Gold Flora is really nailing that vertical aspect, that they have the cultivation, they have the manufacturing and processing, they have the distribution, then they have the 16 stores, and not just 16 stores, but 16 on average above average stores. Not every store is an above average store, but they tend to have really great retail as well. I would add that the things you didn't like about the parent company, maybe some of the things about in terms of the way that they maybe spent too much money and some of the other, we don't need to go into the challenges of the parent company, but they're really committed to not repeating those mistakes. And you're already seeing huge changes in terms of the cost controls and the financial discipline. The Gold Flora management team is largely in charge there. And so I'd encourage people to have another look at that. If you're looking for a way to play California, that's probably the most vertically integrated player in the state.
Okay. I like it. So look, just to wrap up here, Jesse, been very informative. I think there's a lot of good stuff here. And by the way, Jesse also does a weekly Spaces and podcast called Higher Exchanges. That's with Mayor Toby and Morgan Paxia, who are both good guys as well. So, I highly recommend people check that out. But coming to the end here, Jesse, what do you want to leave people with?
Yeah, so I guess what I would want to leave people with is going back to where we started, where I think that we're all in this industry because this is a state-led growth story and because mm-hmm. it does have an interesting series of catalysts ahead. I understand the unease. I understand feeling impatient. I understand feeling beaten down and frustrated, guys. I'm 100% there with you. You know, I invest in these stocks and also, you know, on top of that, you know, try to make a living in this space as well. And it's been super hard over the last 1,132 days. No question. I mean, Manish, you know, I've been in the investing business for almost 25 years, and this is the single worst experience of my life. Worse. Let's just be honest here, right? I was there for the tech bubble. I was there for 2008, the great financial crisis. There was a huge quant unwind, which was not fun for me. But just the duration and magnitude of this drawdown is something that I've never experienced. Yeah. But I think there are signs that we're coming out of it. And I think that this is going to be a very important year for the industry. You know, I think the biggest single thing that could happen for the industry is getting Schedule 3. Mm-hmm. And I'm not here to, I would say that realize that is not a certainty. And if we don't get Schedule 3, I encourage every investor to have some sort of a backup plan. You know, do you think this space is investable, broadly speaking, you know, without, you know, if we land on Schedule 1 or Schedule 2 for some reason, what will you do if we do get Schedule 3? What will you do if we don't get Schedule 3? What kind of names do you want to own coming into this event? Do you want to go with the more the names that may benefit more for reform? Do you want to be more conservative and go with those reform independent names that are more cash flowing? It might be more investable without Schedule 3. Or do you want to give some thought to that thesis that maybe you want to go with the tier ones, which is a little bit of a happy medium and might be where the institutions institutions land? And I would couple that with, again, saying, what states do we have coming online? How optimistic are you about the Pennsylvanias, the Virginias, the Floridas? What sort of names might benefit there, might benefit the most from those sorts of things? So I think this is the most interesting year that I've seen in the cannabis industry, where we have finally, going back to the original thesis about the state-led growth story, we have three key names that could, we could get news about allowing adult use sales in 2024. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, we paired that with being a hot period for this set of, political catalysts, with Schedule 3 being the single biggest thing that could happen to the industry. And that could happen, sometime, between, tomorrow and I think, hopefully, by election time, it doesn't drag out any further than that. So I think it's a super exciting time for the industry. And I appreciate the opportunity to come on and talk about it.
Jesse Redmond, you can catch him on Twitter at Jesse Redmond. I would highly recommend you check out his newsletter as well as his weekly show, CINpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Until next time.
This podcast is a general communication and entertainment being provided for informational purposes only. It is educational in nature and not designed to be a recommendation for any specific investment product, strategy, plan, feature, or other purposes. Any examples used in this podcast are generic, hypothetical, and for entertainment purposes only. None of Cannabis Investing Network or its affiliates are suggesting that the listener or any other person take a specific course of action or any action at all. Communications such as this are not impartial and are provided in connection with advertising and marketing of products and services. Prior to making any investment or financial decisions, an investor should seek individualized advice from a personal financial, legal, tax, and other professional advisor that take into account all of the particular facts and circumstances for an investor's own situation. By listening to this communication, you agree with the intended purpose described earlier. Opinions and statements of financial market trends that are based on current market conditions constitute our judgment and are subject to change without notice. We believe the information provided here is reliable, but should not be assumed to be accurate or complete. The views and strategies described may not be suitable for all investors.